All stations, all call signs. This is Rick Reaction.
Klaus Schwab from the World Economic Forum has said, you will own nothing, and you will love it. And that's represented by what's going on across the planet today, where the economy of the world is in free fall, and nowhere is it more in evidence than with our own President Biden deliberately trying to sabotage what we have. Access to food, other resources. So Americans are in a unique position, really for the first time in our history. We're going to have to provide for ourselves or subject ourselves to the whim of the government. Do you really trust a government to feed you that left 1,000 Americans behind enemy lines in Afghanistan? I don't think so. So where do you go? When you ask the question, who's the best prepper out there today? There's only one answer. Ready-Made Resources and Robert Griswold. I call him King Prepper, and that's how a lot of people think of him. You have everything there you'd want, from night vision to storable food, how to prepare cooking in emergency situations, books and videos on how to prepare alternative energy, communication, first aid that you wouldn't think of, natural antibiotics, you name it, Bob has it. Now, here's the good thing about Bob Griswold that no one else does but him. You don't have to buy anything to talk to him. If you're not sure where to start with your preparation, no obligation phone call directly to Bob. You can talk to him for free. Most people will charge you an arm and a leg for a half-hour conversation. That's not Bob Griswold. He cares about helping America get prepared. Go to readymaderesources.com or you can call the number directly at 800-627-3809. Again, that contact information, readymaderesources.com for the best prepping outfit in the country, or call Bob Griswold directly, 800-627-3809.
Excuse me, as we come in, the allergy's kicking in. Dave Hodges here with Doug Thornton on the Doug and Dave Intel Report. And you can see we have Timothy Alberino with us, author of Birthright. We're going to get into one of those aspects. I'll tell you, if you don't have that book, and I know Tim, we'll give Tim an opportunity to tell you how to get it. You need to get this book and read it. I'm still picking it up from time to time, and I've had it for close to a year now. And I'll go through and go, oh, I'm going to reread that one part. It's absolutely phenomenal. And tonight we're going to talk about the flood in Atlantis. And it sounds like, are those two related? Tim will connect the dots for us. So Tim, welcome to the show. And I got to tell you, this is so much fun doing this kind of report and kind of skipping the geopolitics and getting into real history. This is fun.
It's great to be back with you guys. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. So the book you wrote is, I got to tell you, you could have written 10 books out of what's in Birthright, because you go in so many different levels and different dimensions of creation, our past, our true history. And how did you arrive at the fact that there really was an Atlantis? And I'd like to use that as a starting point, and then you can take that wherever you want.
Well, Atlantis, as an actual historical city, is debatable. I happen to believe that Atlantis did exist as a historical city, but at the very least, what's not debatable, and what I highlight in this video that we're going to discuss here, is that Atlantis is an allegory of the Golden Age in the antediluvian world. So in other words, Atlantis is an allegory of the pre-flood world before the events chronicled in Genesis 6, the events chronicled in the book of Enoch leading up to the great flood, the Noahic flood. And so as an allegory, it is true. It is historically accurate as an allegory. Now, again, whether Atlantis was itself an actual city is debatable. I happen to believe it was, but, you know, until we actually find it, that's unknown.
Well, the Greeks referenced it historically.
Plato did. Yeah. In his Critias dialogue, Plato references Atlantis, and it's in a historical context. And the Egyptians, according to Plato. Plato was recounting a conversation that his ancestor Solon of Athens, the famous Greek statesman Solon of Athens, was visited to Egypt back in 600 BC, and he went and had this fascinating conversation with the priests of Saith in the city, of the priests of Naith, Athena, in the city of Sais in Egypt. And they informed him that the Greeks are basically children in terms of what they know about the historical past, and that their history doesn't go back very far. And so then they proceed to relate the story of Atlantis to Solon. And this is what Plato is recounting in the Critias dialogue. And they record, they had records of Atlantis as if it was an actual historical city, and that was destroyed in a historical documented cataclysm. And I equate that cataclysm with the great flood of biblical fame.
Now, let me ask you a question. That was in Critias. Was it also in, was it Timaeus around 360 BCE?
Yeah, the Timaeus and the Critias. It's a dialogue, and the part that Plato is, the primary part where he's talking about Atlantis or Solon, mm-hmm. where this dialogue is happening, is in the Critias dialogue.
Now, you get into it to where you said that it almost seemed like there was at one time a possible war between Athens and Atlantis.
Well, this is right out of Plato's account. The Egyptians, the priests of Naith, told Solon that the Atlanteans had been locked in a protracted bloody conflict with Athens, with the city of Athens, the city-state of Athens, and that Athens was the only power at the time. Again, this is in the context of the antediluvian world, the pre-flood world. Athens was the only power at the time able to resist the might of Atlantis, because Atlantis was not just a city. Manly P. Hall, the famous, the celebrated Masonic scholar, writes considerably about, he has a lot to say about Atlantis in his book, The New Atlantis, and he's drawing on ancient sources as well, and besides Plato. And both Manly P. Hall and Plato talk about Atlantis in the context of an empire. So it's not just a city. There is a city, which Plato says was, which the priests of Naith told Solon was founded by the god Poseidon. But Atlantis grew into an empire, and it was an aggressive expansionist empire, and it was unstoppable. Manly P. Hall says that this empire, the Atlantean Empire, ruled over seven continents. Ruled over seven islands and three continents.
Do you think that was near the Dardanelles? Isn't that how it was identified by the Greeks?
I'm sorry?
The location.
Well, the location in Plato's account, in the Critias dialogue, the location is somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean, because the priests of Naith informed Solon that that's where the Atlantic Ocean derives its name. And in fact, it does. The Atlantic Ocean is named Atlantic Ocean because of the legend of Atlantis. Now, where in the Atlantic Ocean is it? Who knows? You know, at one time I postulated that perhaps Sardinia in the Mediterranean might have been Atlantis. You know, everybody, we've played around with lots of different ideas. Nobody knows exactly where Atlantis
was. What I was trying to ask, and maybe I'm wrong on this, Tim, but I thought Plato, but I'm not sure, it could have been someone else, tried to pin the location near the Dardanelles.
Most people think that Atlantis was located, and the residue of the island is still to be seen. Not the Canary Islands, the Azores.
Okay,
and I'm not sure that that's true. I think that there has been a lot of work done in the past, a lot of scientific inquiry into the Azores using ground penetrating radar, radar equipment and sonar. And I don't think that there's any megalithic I would expect to find megalithic constructions if it's Atlantis. But who knows? I mean, it all depends on how devastating the cataclysm was. I mean, you have a cataclysm that's devastating enough, it can completely erase all traces of human activity.
Sure. Absolutely.
Can I ask you something? Because if Atlantis is on the floor of the ocean now, due to whatever cataclysm happened, could it be that ground penetrating radar can't see any of the formations because of maybe the growth of coral reefs, barriers being changed?
That's always possible. And maybe the equipment that's been used, that's been deployed, is not yet capable of finding evidence of Atlantis. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the quest continues. It's a famous query for explorers and scientists.
Yeah. Tim, let me ask one more location question. I saw some stuff at one time, and we're going back 30 years now, so the memory starts to fade. But they thought Atlantis might have been near something called the Bienemy Road that they found on the floor of the ocean. Are you familiar with that?
That's in the Bahamas, is it not?
Yes. Yeah, that's going through the triangle, I believe, right?
Yeah, that's near Bermuda.
Yeah.
And then there's an extension of that that says the Bermuda Triangle weird effects could be remnant energy from Atlantis still emanating, whatever. Listen, I don't know if this is true or not, but I found the evidence of the Bienemy Road to be pretty compelling, that something in terms of a civilization had been there, whether it was Atlantis or not. Certainly. I think it's open to debate.
Certainly. Yeah, there's all kinds of megalithic structures under the water. We've only just begun to discover some of them, but there are certainly massive megalithic, probably the largest megalithic constructions in the world are underwater. And that has to do with the Younger Dryas impact. I believe it has to do with the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. But so according, if you read Plato's account in the Critias, you do get the sense that he is, what he's saying is that Atlantis is through the Straits of Gibraltar, right out into the Atlantic Ocean. Manly P. Hall, I think, insinuates that America, that the United North America was Atlantis. He and other people have also hypothesized that North America might actually be Atlantis, or Atlantis was in North America. There's a compelling case to be made for that. I'm not sure that it's true, because North America really wouldn't qualify as an island. I mean, who would ever describe North America as an island? So it's doubtful in my mind. I think if Atlantis did actually exist, it was an island. And again, it's very specific in the account that Atlantis ruled over other islands, seven other islands, and held sway over three continents. That's an empire. That's a massive empire.
Yeah, Africa and that is in Europe, right?
Certainly Africa. Yeah, Africa and parts. And it almost sounds like, you know, an early manifestation of the Roman Empire in some respects. The area surrounding the Mediterranean, or at least half of the Mediterranean. Well, let's put it this way: all the way up to Greece, because Athens withstood the onslaught of Atlantis, which means that this empire was encroaching into Greece. And so if it started in the Atlantic Ocean and now it's encroaching on the city of Athens, that's an empire. That's a whole lot of territory that Atlantis would have been dominating. So
I wonder if the Iranians have any legends on this, because you think Persia would have been involved if Greece was being enveloped.
You know, everybody, all of these ancient civilizations have an Atlantis-like mythology. The Indians have famous mythologies that are very reminiscent of Atlantis. Even in Peru, and in Central America, the Inca and the Aztec, they had legends that were reminiscent of Atlantis. Everybody had an Atlantis, a lost city, a lost civilization, mythos. It's ubiquitous around the world. It goes hand in glove with the mythos regarding a great cataclysm that destroyed this great civilization and that nearly annihilated the human species.
Let me ask you a question. Has there been anything that would be in reference to architecture, art, or even similar folk telling from Europe and Africa and maybe even South America? Because in my mind, if you were going to put Atlantis somewhere, it would seem more to be around South America than North America. And also, I think sometimes we forget that landscape has changed dramatically in 10,000 years, especially with the falling of the sea level. So maybe at one point in time, wherever Atlantis was, if it was across the pond, it did appear to be a very large island, maybe like a New Zealand or even like an Australia, even though it's a continent of itself. It could have appeared to be that way because the water was so much higher then.
Well, Atlantis, if this empire was able to go east from, let's just assume from somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean between the Straits of Gibraltar and the North American continent, they're able to head east and penetrate all the way into the Mediterranean, all the way to the city of Athens in Greece, then what's stopping them from going west and going to the North American continent and furthermore going down to Central and South America? And many people have speculated that the Atlantean Empire did penetrate into these areas. And that's why you have these ubiquitous civilizational anomalies that show up in all these different cultures that seem to have the same source. In other words, like a mother culture, a mother civilization from which all of these other civilizations derive some of their religious practices and some of their mythologies and so forth. So, of course, that could all go back to Sumer as well. Could go all the way back to it would go back to in the post-flood sense, it would go back to Sumer, the first Sumer and Akkadia, the first and ancient Egypt, the first major civilizations in the post-diluvian world, in the world after the Noahic flood. Atlantis is in the context of the world before the Noahic flood. And so Atlantis is part of what I call the empire of the gods. And this was the title of the video that I just published on my YouTube channel. And I encourage anybody listening, if they want to get a much more concise explanation of all this, to go to my YouTube channel and watch that video, Empire of the Gods. It's in English and in Spanish, by the way. There's a Spanish version and an English version. It's part of my Birthright series. And in that video, I discuss what's called the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, because much of my career has revolved around investigating the antediluvian civilizations, and that would include the Watchers, the Nephilim, and the cataclysm that destroyed them. So as I've traveled around the world looking at megaliths, starting to get a feel for, at least formulate my own opinion as to when most of these megaliths were constructed, I started to realize that I think I have to look deeper in the past than I'm accustomed to looking, because some years ago, maybe 5-6 years ago, perhaps even sooner, I was pretty convinced that the flood of Noah had occurred sometime around 3500 BC, maybe 4000 BC, somewhere in that neighborhood. And as I was confronted with certain realities that I couldn't deny, such as there's some of these megalithic constructions around the world are unquestionably aligned to celestial phenomena that dates to 10,000 BC.
Yeah.
And so as I was confronted with this data, which again I believe to be undeniable in certain circumstances, I had to reconfigure my timeline, and evidence began to pile up for me personally in my pursuit of knowledge in this field of study. And ultimately, I had to sort of acquiesce to what I was encountering, what I was discovering. And so I, in my mind, I pushed the flood back from 3500 BC, 3500 BC. I pushed it back to 10,000 BC, thereabouts, somewhere in that the neighborhood of 10,000 BC. And when I did that, it seemed like everything was fitting into place much better in terms of the evidence that I was finding in the field.
That's a really amazing date. Let me interrupt you and ask you this question, because I thought this very thing when I watched your video. The date of 10,000 years, do you think people are confusing an ice age with this asteroid strike?
Yes, and there's a reason why. And I was confused about the ice age situation when I was contemplating 10,000 BC. 10,000 BC is the deep past. I mean, we all are taught to think about 10,000 BC as basically a time of the cavemen or the Neanderthals, and that we're talking about the Neolithic age. The Stone Age, you know, Fred Flintstone. And I think actually in reality, it was exactly the opposite of that. I think it was a pinnacle of civilization, and it we can talk about why in a moment, but so and I'm kind of walking people through how I got to this, because there's a lot of controversy surrounding my view on this. So I realized, having studied these megaliths and looking at different aspects of mythology, including the legend of Atlantis, by the way, which I'll tie back in here in a minute regarding the date, everything was pointing to sometime around 10,000 BC, somewhere in the neighborhood of 10,000 BC. That's when this antediluvian civilization came to an abrupt end in a cataclysm. Now, the Christians, we can recognize that cataclysm. We call it the Great Flood, or the Noahic Flood, or the Flood of Noah. We don't have any problem with the notion that a cataclysm occurred, that a cataclysm rocked the earth and destroyed everything, save eight people, right, on the ark. But I think we've been getting the time frame wrong. We've been doing some, I think, inaccurate calculating in terms of time. And we've been getting a date that is 6,000 years too soon. I think we have to push the flood back to 10,000 BC. And when we do that, all this other data falls right into place. And it happens that this time frame, somewhere in the neighborhood of 10,000 BC, give or take 1,000 years, who knows? I mean, we're talking about the deep past there. But somewhere in the neighborhood of 10,000 BC, this notion that that's when the great cataclysm, the great flood occurred, that seems to directly correspond to a new hypothesis that's been formulated in scientific communities. And this hypothesis is not conventional scientific thinking. This is a hypothesis that was formulated by some geologists, natural physicists, and different guys from different fields, scientific fields, and they came together and they were discovering this evidence. And so they formed this what they call the Comet Research Group, and they started publishing their findings in the scientific journals. And man, did they get it was almost as if they were saying, hey, the flood of Noah was real. They weren't saying that. That's not what they're saying. But it was the vitriol that came from the scientific community. It was almost as if that's what they were saying. You know, they were making some kind of a biblical truth claim, which isn't what they were doing. What they were doing was they were finding evidence and publishing papers that suggested that sometime around 12 to 13,000 years ago, a comet, or more likely fragments of a massive comet, collided with the surface of the Earth and caused unimaginable destruction, led to a global cataclysm. And that this in part that this explains the sudden disappearance of the megafauna and all kinds of things that were that happened during a period of time that's called the Younger Dryas. Now the Younger Dryas is a period of time between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago, so roughly 10,800 BC, 9,600 to 10,800 BC, somewhere in that time frame. This geological phenomenon called the Younger Dryas occurred. And the Younger Dryas was an abrupt return to ice age conditions after a prolonged period of warming. So suddenly, between 9,600 BC and 10,800 BC, somewhere in that window, the Earth suddenly returned, abruptly was returned to ice age conditions. And we know that that happened for sure. I mean, the data is conclusive. When you take a look at the data of the Younger Dryas, it's really difficult to dispute. And nobody knew why. Why did this happen? And everybody assumed, I think rightly assumed, that this was the demise of the megafauna. Of course, the megafauna being the mastodons and the giant sloths and the saber-toothed tigers, all of these animals, by the way, that were inhabiting all of North America.
That was an ELE, an extinction level event, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, and it killed more megafaunal mammals during that event. More megafaunal mammals died than the amount of mammals currently alive on the planet.
So
it was a massive extinction event.
Can you explain the flash freezing? Because we have been finding these prehistoric creatures for decades, flash frozen with food still in their mouth, like some of the mammoths.
Yeah.
Can you explain that?
Yeah. Let me walk people through the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis very quickly, because and then I'll address the flash freezing. So the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis postulates that the Younger Dryas, this sudden abrupt return to ice age conditions, was catalyzed by a cataclysm that was caused by a comet or fragments of a comet impacting the Earth, and specifically not just impacting the Earth in any random place. Most likely those impacts occurred in North America, and in North America, specifically the North American ice sheet, what's called the Laurentide ice sheet, which back in 10,000 BC was 1 to 2 miles thick. So, and where I'm sitting right now in Montana was completely covered in glacial ice. And so what you have to imagine.
Was true north at Nova Scotia then?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Because when you talk about the ice in North America, I've read that before the last ice age, and this is, I think, fairly solid. They thought true north at one time was Nova Scotia. That would make a lot of sense from what you're describing.
I think that's true. But imagine these fragments of a massive comet breaking into pieces. Comet breaks up into pieces, and the Earth gets bombarded with dozens, hundreds, thousands of fragments of this comet. Who knows? But these fragments, they collide with the North American ice cap, with the Laurentide ice sheet. And when a comet collides with the Earth, I mean, this thing is moving at 30 miles per second. These fragments are going to be moving at 30 miles per second. When a comet or an asteroid or some kind of a cosmic body gets pulled into our atmosphere, when it collides with the Earth, it's about the most calamitous thing that can happen on planet Earth.
Right.
It generates the collision itself. The explosion generates heat equivalent to the surface of the sun. It's many, many times more powerful than an atomic bomb. In some cases, it can be thousands or even millions of times more powerful. But let's assume that the comet, a big comet, broke up into pieces, and it was like a shotgun blast, birdshot on the surface of the Earth, comet fragment birdshot. Each one of those fragments would be like, you know, would be like nuclear warheads that are hundreds of times more powerful than anything we have today. Now imagine those explosions happening on a mile high ice sheet. What's going to happen? What's going to happen to that ice? It's going to be vaporized and it's going to be liquefied rapidly. Mm-hmm. You're talking about unbelievable amounts of water that are suddenly rushing into the ocean, fresh water, suddenly being released from these ice, from the glacial ice, and rushing into the sea. So North America, and we know this for sure now, North America, a big portion of North America had a, you know, 100-foot tidal wave just sweep across it when these, when the Laurentide ice sheet melted, suddenly melted. Again, those explosions were generating heats that are equivalent to the surface of the sun. And so right there, you have a whole lot of fresh water going in the ocean. You're going to have the ocean levels rise, and you're going to have tsunamis from the falling ice and also just the shaking, the quaking of the earth from the impacts. It's going to set off chain reactions of volcanic explosions all over the earth. And you're going to have what's called ejecta, the molten shrapnel from the comet impacts is going all over the place, landing in all over the earth and in forests, and literally just consuming and setting the world ablaze. And so you have all of these different catastrophic things happening, compounding to create this global cataclysm. Yes, a global flood. Absolutely. There was flooding, on massive flooding, catastrophic flooding on every continent, but you also had wildfires. They estimate that 10% of the world's forests were burned, of vegetation of the earth was burned in a very short period of time in this massive biomass burning event.
And survivors would have suffocated, wouldn't they?
Yeah, certainly. So you can imagine it truly is an extinction level event. And this is basically, you know, that was a very crude explanation of the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. So in a nutshell, we're talking about a comet impact about, let's say, 12,000 years ago, thereabouts, somewhere around 10,000 BC, multiple fragments of a comet hitting the ice sheets in North America and just wreaking havoc on planet Earth, all over the earth. I mean, it was a global cataclysm. And so when I encountered the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, it matched up with everything that I was studying and my own, the conclusions that I had been drawing about this cataclysm that happened in around 10,000 BC, pushing the flood back. And again, I'm talking about the flood of Noah. Pushing the flood of Noah back to 10,000 BC, it just matched up with the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. And there's a whole lot of evidence now. In fact, slowly, as I said in the beginning, the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis was not well received by the scientific community at all. And now slowly the scientific community is beginning to recognize that this is a valid hypothesis. And in fact, it very possibly might be true. And it's gained a lot of popularity because Joe Rogan interviewed Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson on his podcast. And they on several occasions, and Graham Hancock has written about this in several of his books, and other people have talked about the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, and it's really great, gaining traction now. And again, and by the way, to address what Doug was talking about, when a cosmic body, an asteroid or a comet, enters the atmosphere of the Earth, if it's big enough and it's moving at such incredible speeds that it literally pulls in the sub-zero atmosphere of outer space in its wake. So it's like you can imagine it punching through our atmosphere and pulling in that Arctic air. It's not even really air because there's very little air in outer space, but it's like an Arctic blast that busts through our atmosphere, and it just in a certain radius around the impact. So you have this superheated impact, you know, again, the temperature is equivalent to the surface of the sun. But then in other places you have this this freezing air that came in from outer space, and it just is getting blasted all over the ground. And anything that's in the path of this Arctic blast is literally flash frozen in place. It is so cold and it's coming in so fast that you wouldn't even know it. You would literally just be frozen stiff in place. Whatever you were doing, you're just frozen. You're not running. You don't even know it happened. You're just dead. You're frozen.
So I would imagine that this celestial body, as it's leaving the vacuum of space, it's hitting our atmosphere, is probably engaging in multiple various different sonic booms. And that is, if you've ever seen a sonic boom, is kind of like pushing out the mass overpressure of whatever it was carrying with itself. And that is the explanation of that. And you know, that makes sense, because it's almost like, if you study this, because I was starting to study it, where they're finding a lot of this is in the subarctic region of Russia, that entire area.
The northern hemisphere.
Yeah, that is the land before time, that, you know, it's very hard for people to get in and do archaeological digs in there. But what they are finding is expressing the value of some sort of a flash freeze. And they've also found the same thing, not just with the mammals, not just the mammalian species that are found, but also viral and bacterial species that are dating back, you know, 10,000 years or more.
Yeah, any living thing.
Number 10,000 keeps coming up.
Any living thing that's in the path of this Arctic blast coming in from outer space is going to get frozen solid instantly frozen. So whatever's in the path of the Arctic blast, instantly frozen. Whatever's in the vicinity, ground zero of the comet impact, instantly vaporized. Both of those things happening. And that's why we find today mammoths with food in their mouth. They were casually chewing their food, eating, and then suddenly they're frozen in place. And you can see pictures of these mammoths online. They're just frozen solid and remain so until we dug them up. A couple of the most impressive ones were dug up in China and in Russia, in Siberia. Of course, we have them in North America as well. It was
Doug,
just
before we leave the timeline, though, I'd like to go back to what you said about 10,600 years ago, because you put a nagging thought in my head, and I want you to dispel it. And I'm just throwing a dart in the air here, okay? I'm not proposing anything. But one, I never believed the Egyptians built the pyramids. Two, I know there's been water erosion at the base of the pyramids and the Sphinx. It's been repaired three times. But they go back and they say, and they use the term Ice Age, the last time there had been enough water to go that high up on those structures was before the last Ice Age 10,600 years ago.
Yes.
Could it be the pyramids predated all this? And
well, when you say Ice Age, when you say an Ice Age before 10,000 years ago, that what you're talking about is like a mini Ice Age. That's the Younger Dryas. That is a return to Ice Age conditions for about 1,000 years. That is in a post-flood context. And the reason why, and by the way, this comet impact hypothesis is, it's the only hypothesis that answers all the questions. How do you get, you know, massive flooding all over the Earth? Well, the comet impact happened on the Laurentide ice sheets in North America. So it released tons of water, tons, millions of cubic miles of water were released into the ocean. How do you get animals flash frozen in place? A comet pulling in the sub-zero vacuum of outer space and blasting them with it, basically. You get that. That's how you get that. So
let me ask one more follow-up on this. What if it wasn't a comet and it was a weapon?
It would have been a weapon that would have to be equivalent to a comet, you know, or fragments of a massive comet hitting the Earth. It would have to be absolutely a world-destroying weapon, like a Death Star. Almost.
Okay, so let me ask you this question, because it might be totally unrelated. But do you remember it was maybe 15, 20 years ago, scientists announced they found bacteria from Mars. I think it was the North Pole.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, well, how the hell would it get there?
Was that panspermia? Isn't that what it's called?
Panspermia is, the theory that life on Earth was seeded from a comet or from extraterrestrial beings.
That's kind of where I was going with this.
Engineering life.
Because you talk about the nature of Atlantis and who actually lived there.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's so what before, I call the Empire of the Gods.
That's why I asked the question.
Okay. Well, let's tie this in back into Atlantis. So what's and I learned this part from Graham Hancock, who does great work on this subject, and the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis and lost civilizations. But it turns out that in the Critias account, and it's plain in Plato's account in the Critias dialogue, but as I said, the priests of Nath informed Solon that Atlantis was destroyed 9,000 years before their present age. They told him that. We have records of Atlantis that it was destroyed 9,000 years before our present age. They told Solon. Well, we know that Solon visited Egypt in 600 BC. So what we get is the year 9,600 BC. The Egyptians believed, according to their records, that Atlantis was destroyed somewhere around 10,000 BC. We got to give some padding for error in the reckoning of the Egyptians. And as we do also with the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, their dates are approximate. And so the Egyptian dates would also be approximate. I don't think that any ancient culture would have had records so pristine that they could have calculated to the exact year, you know, going 9,000 years into the past. So we got to give some cushion room on both the hypothesis and the calculations of the Egyptians. But what we can say is that both of the hypothesis, the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, and the legend of Atlantis, according to the reckoning of the Egyptians, both of those things, the destruction of Atlantis, occurred around the same time, within the same general period of time. And I don't think that's coincidental. I think that Atlantis was destroyed, or what Atlantis represents, the Empire of the Gods, was destroyed during the Younger Dryas impact, the comet impact, and that it occurred sometime around 10,000 BC.
Hey, I got so a that's question. Pretty. I got a question for you, because you just sparked an interest with me. All right, so we keep talking about this 10,000 to like 14,000 BC time frame with Atlantis.
10,000 BC, some 12,000.
I think it's 12,900 is like the latest that they were dating.
Yeah, they fluctuate. Some say 12,800. They bumped it up to 12,900 recently.
So it's like middle Paleolithic. What about the Denisovans? Because there's very little archaeological remains from the Denisovans. There are some molars, which are they're like 30% larger than the average human molar. Very little is known, but the most that we've gotten anything from them is mitochondrial DNA remains. Found also in Russia and China. You know, what's interesting is that if there was a large enough explosion, a extinction level event that destroyed mankind, destroyed the megafauna and the megaflora, could there have been another race, human-like, maybe not human, maybe Homo sapien, but archaic enough to be in that species variety that was part of what the fallen angels had created, that was part of the destruction, and that is the Denisovans, as we call it, because we don't really have an actual name for them. They're just found in the cave in
Denisovans. Yeah, you have the Denisovans, you have the Neanderthals. I think first of all, we have to address this issue of dating for a moment. The methods by which they date the Younger Dryas and the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, it's not carbon dating. They base it on glacial core samples and also on the geological layers in the earth. There's a whole lot of evidence there that we could go over, but I think it would be pretty boring. But there's a whole lot of material there on how they derive these dates as it pertains to the Younger Dryas and the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. So it's not carbon dating. However, carbon dating is notoriously inaccurate with very long periods of time, but it's pretty good with shorter periods of time. And there's reasons for that, which we don't have to go into. But carbon dating seems to be pretty good when you're going out, you know, a few thousand years, maybe up to 10,000, maybe back to around 10,000 years. But when you go beyond, when you start to get into deep, really, really prehistoric dates, like 20,000 years ago, it's almost useless, in my opinion. It's almost completely useless. And so people might say, well, how can you subscribe to the data coming to the data supporting the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, but not then accept the data from the same body of data that's pointing to mankind being around for 200,000 years and things happening, you know, the dinosaurs being millions of years old? And the simple answer to that is because the technology that we're using to date all of these things and these historical events, as I said, it has some degree of accuracy in the short term, in the shorter term, but it completely loses its accuracy in the long term. So, so it is ice core data, and now don't conflate this ice core data with the nonsense that they're talking about. They're using the same ice core data to push climate change, which in fact the ice core data negates climate change. Randall Carlson does some great lectures on this. It completely refutes man-made climate change the way that it's being pushed today. So that data doesn't actually confirm climate change, so just so people know. So there's a scientific body of data that is mounting, as I said to me, it's mounting. Now, as it pertains to the Neanderthals and the Denisovans, I don't know what those bones are. And when we say bones, let's be clear. We're talking about like a tooth.
Yeah, one of them was
like a fingertip or something. You know, yeah. for the Denisovans, I don't know that those represent a separate species or a subspecies of the human species of Homo sapien. So they do, but I'm very doubtful of that. Based on this, it just seems like a massive leap to me. But that it could be, and I know where you guys are going, that the Denisovans or the Neanderthals were actually a different hybrid species that came about as a result of the activity of the Watchers in the pre-flood world, some kind of a Nephilim species, I guess we could say. And I don't know. I don't know that the DNA is that different from ours. In my opinion, they're probably just human beings. And they may, you know, the Answers in Genesis guys, Kent Ham and those guys, they believe that Neanderthals are just really, really, really old people. Like because their brows are longer and their jaws are bigger. And there's features about the Neanderthal skulls that they argue are just the kind of features that you would expect on a 500, if a person lived 500 years. So you have all of this floating around. You have that theory that these are just old humans. You have a theory that they're not humans at all. They're just hominids. They're more apes than they are humans. Maybe there's some kind of a Bigfoot creature. Then you have other theories that they're subspecies of humans. They were the pre-modern humans. And then you guys have thrown into the mix another theory, which is, might they be some kind of a genetically altered species? So all of that is floating around, and I don't really know what to make of any of it, honestly.
But I think your ideas are right on the money, and I think there's ancillary proof that if we really develop this, I think we could fit together this jigsaw puzzle. I think the Aztecs and the Mayas have some of it. I think the pyramids are part of it. I think what they found in the Wang province of China is part of it. Yamaguni off the coast of Cuba, as in terms of underwater civilization. I think there's so much ancillary proof for what you're saying. I really do. When I listen to this, I'd really like you to address the notion of the giants in Atlantis and go down that route.
Right. So when we talk about let's put ourselves in the context of 10,000 BC. Okay, so we're pushing the flood of Noah back. So help, I'm trying to help people track with me here in the biblical timeline. Push the flood of Noah back from 3,500 BC, push it back to 10,000 BC. Push it back so that it lines up with the date given by the Egyptians for the destruction of Atlantis and the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. Let's put the flood there. And let's assume that the watchers were inhabiting the earth, that the watchers were walking among, the gods were walking among men, and that their giant offspring, the Nephilim, were in the earth at the time of Atlantis. And I go further. I say that Atlantis was actually, whether it was an actual city or not, but that prototype, that template of the golden age that Atlantis certainly represents was in effect at that time, before this cataclysm, before the comet strike. So the real thing, the real question that intrigues me and has intrigued me for many years now is, what did that world actually look like? What was the level of technology that was being employed in the antediluvian world? And when you take the legend of Atlantis and you take the Book of Enoch and the biblical account, the Genesis account, and then you take something we haven't discussed yet, the epics of India, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, and other ancient accounts besides, you can begin to put these puzzle pieces together and start to get a visage of what the antediluvian world actually looked like. And like I say at the end of my video, when you put all these pieces together, you realize that even C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien couldn't have written anything so epic and fantastical as what we have in the antediluvian world. Because what we have, according to all these ancient sources, including the Book of Genesis, including the Book of Enoch, including the legend of Atlantis, all these other things, is you have a situation that in which a period of time, which the ancient Egyptians refer to as Zeptepi, the first time when the gods literally lived among men. They lived openly among men. They were worshipped in the flesh. And in fact, the story of Atlantis, as told by Plato, is a template for this scenario, because Plato starts the narrative of Atlantis starts off with the gods who are doing what? They're dividing the earth amongst themselves. They're apportioning the earth amongst themselves. And each one of the gods takes a portion of the earth, and he, in using Poseidon as an example, because Poseidon is the one who founded Atlantis, they choose a wife from among the daughters of men. Poseidon chooses Clito, the daughter of a man named Evanor, and he founds the city of Atlantis for his part, his portion of this. They divvied up the earth into portions amongst the gods, and Poseidon received for his portion Atlantis. He chose to wed Clado, a human woman, and he copulated with Clado, and she gave birth to five pairs of twin sons who became the kings of Atlantis. And other ancient sources describe those sons as giants, by the way. And so you have this template that fits perfectly with the Book of Enoch. Perfectly with the Book of Enoch. And because I've always said that the Book of Enoch, it doesn't say it directly. You're not going to find any sentence that says this directly, but the Book of Enoch insinuates very strongly that the watchers were basically creating an empire on the earth, and that their giant hybrid offspring were governing this empire. So they were the kings of the empire of the gods. And so, you know, we can imagine that the watchers, according to the Book of Enoch, there were 200 of these extraterrestrial beings. That's exactly what they were. They were extraterrestrial beings who descended to the summit of Hermon And I contend that they descended to the summit of Hermon in advanced aerospace vehicles. And these 200 watchers, living gods among men, when they descended into the plains, they everybody knows the story. They chose wives from the daughters of men. I don't think they threw them over their shoulder and raped them, then just took them as so many imagine. I don't think they were just, I want that woman, and they hoist her over their shoulder. No, what we have is a bargain. And we talked about this, I think, on your show in the past. There's a bargain being struck, because the watchers weren't looking to rape women. They were looking for wives. They wanted to marry the daughters of men. And marriage, the contract of marriage in the ancient world, was much more serious than it is today.
As like between kings and kingdoms.
Well, it was much more serious in the sense that a woman was given away by her father. It was a contract. So the fathers would give their daughters' hands in marriage. And so the watchers likely went to the fathers and said, I want to marry your daughter. These are gods among men approaching the offspring of Adam, who are, by the way, pretty much like gods among men themselves compared to us. You know, the offspring of Adam in the antediluvian world were just far superior to us in every way, physically and mentally speaking. They were far superior to us. And so the watchers are striking a deal with these men, the fathers of the daughters they want to marry. You give us legally, we can talk about, I think we've talked about that, why it had to be a legal transaction, but you give us legally your daughter's hands in marriage, and we will teach you the knowledge that you have been striving to learn, as the Book of Enoch puts it. So this was a transaction. It was, in every sense of the word, a Faustian bargain, because the watchers knew what the result of this was going to be. Because when they married these women and they had intercourse with them, what the men probably didn't realize was that the women were going to give birth to giants, or the offspring of this union between the gods and mortal women was going to result in giants, and the giants would be just superior to the antediluvian humans and would basically take over the earth and dethrone human kings and basically usurp dominion of the earth. I talk about that in the video I did. And so you have this scenario that is exactly the way that Plato paints this panorama of the antediluvian world. It's precisely the way that the Book of Enoch paints this panorama of the antediluvian world, the gods dividing the earth amongst themselves, choosing wives from among the children of men. The wives are giving birth to hybrid demigods who are becoming the kings of their father's realms. And the father, and by the way, in the story of Atlantis, the gods, after they apportion the earth amongst themselves, and it's human beings inhabiting the earth when they're doing this, after they apportion the earth amongst themselves, they build temples for their own veneration. They build themselves temples, and they institute sacrifices for themselves. I think this is exactly what the watchers did. They wanted to be worshipped. And so who knows, some of these megalithic constructions might have been the temples of the watchers in the antediluvian world. And then the Book of Enoch talks about the giants devouring mankind, that mankind had to feed the giants. It says that mankind had to feed the giants so that all the acquisitions of the giants were consuming all the acquisitions of the land. And when men could no longer feed the giants devoured mankind. And so when I picture this, I don't picture a bunch of, fee-fi-fo-fum stupid giants walking around with clubs over their shoulders. I envision giant kings, just like the 10 kings of Atlantis, giant kings governing the kingdoms of the gods, the empire of the gods, and human sacrifices, human beings being brought into the temples as a quota of human flesh to satisfy the sanguinary appetites of these giants. And it was an empire. And so then the question, if I'm right in this hypothesis of mine, then we also have to throw into this equation the knowledge and the technology of the elder race, of the watchers, needs to be inserted into this situation. Because the watchers taught mankind certain things, but they reserved the best of their knowledge for their wives and their sons, which makes perfect sense. If you want to maintain your dynastic control, the control of your hereditary line over the human populace, you're not going to give the human beings all the best knowledge and teach them how to make technology that maybe they can turn on you and try and dethrone you. You're going to give it to your family. You're going to keep it in the family, so to speak. So what do we have? When we add all of this together, and I'm just sort of spitballing here, I put it together much better in my video, much more coherently. But what do we have? I believe we have a scenario in which you have a Bronze Age level, in some respects, a Bronze Age level civilization, generally speaking, the populace of humanity, a Bronze Age level, but in certain aspects, very, very technologically advanced in certain aspects because of the knowledge that came from the Watchers. And this Bronze Age level mass of humanity is being governed by these tyrannical giant kings who are in possession of what I think can only be described as extraterrestrial technology that came directly from their fathers. Coincides with some movies that have been made, especially the movie Stargate. And I referenced this in my video. If you remember, in the movie Stargate, you have interesting because it was one of the first movies that portrayed a Stargate, which I think are real, that you can utilize to traverse space time, basically. And in the movie, you have precisely what I just said. You have, so these soldiers go through this Stargate and end up on a different planet. And on this planet, you have a Bronze Age civilization that you learn later that was actually taken from ancient Egypt. And they're being, they're subjugated to an extraterrestrial being who's taken on human form and who's worshipped openly as a god in the flesh. And he has these agents around him who have this technological headgear on that looks like the hawk head, Horus. And they have advanced technology, and they're using this advanced technology basically to keep the people in line. And so I think that's actually probably a very accurate depiction of what's
going on. And Tim, back to my question about the pyramids, that was the source of the power. And the only reason I brought that up is because the timeline matches. I got to ask you a couple questions here. This is amazing. If I didn't have the first minutes of our conversation together, and I just heard you talking for the last 10 minutes without any time reference, I would wonder if you're talking about today. Let me ask you a pointed question. Do you think that there was an attempt to keep the fallen ones' bloodline pure away from humans as much as possible?
I would say so. When we talk about giants, the question really becomes, how big were these giants? Because it may be a scenario in which the giants were born normal-sized babies. We know that according to the Book of Enoch, and I don't know that the Book of Enoch is veritable history as opposed to mythologizing a veritable history. But if according to the Book of Enoch, the Watchers' wives were still alive when the Watchers were judged. And the wives were also judged in a unique way. They became sirens, according to the Book of Enoch. So the Watchers' wives were alive. What does that tell us? It tells us that they didn't die during childbirth. That's what that tells us. That tells us that they didn't give birth to their bellies didn't split open and these massive fetuses roll out. That's not what happened. They gave birth, most likely, otherwise they would have died, to normal-sized or relatively normal-sized babies. And that those babies experienced an accelerated growth through their lives. Now, the question is, and this is an important question, track with me on this. So if the giants just popped out giants, they just pop out giants, right? And the women's bellies or wombs are split open and they just got these gigantic babies rolling around. Then those giants could only copulate with each other. Assuming that there were females and not just males. However, if you have giant, if you have hybrid offspring that are born of the union of Watchers and human women, and they are normal sized human beings into their adolescence before the acceleration really takes off, then they can copulate with human women. Could they not? And so if you have giants who are like, you know, people with gigantism who are maybe for the first up until 13, 14, 15 years old are relatively speaking normal size, maybe on the larger end, but their growth does not accelerate until a certain period of time, because babies with gigantism are often born normal size. And then they have this because of the tumor on their pituitary gland. The growth just doesn't turn off. That's what happens. It's a tumor on the pituitary gland, and the growth, the body just, the brain just keeps telling the body to grow, and the chemicals just keep pumping into the body. So it grows. But they're still people with gigantism, you know, into their teens, they're still appropriately sized, let's say, to have intercourse with women and procreate. So if the giants were able to do that, if their growth was not yet accelerated to such a degree that it would just kill the women that they, you know, not to get too graphic here, but that they had intercourse with, if they were able to reproduce before that acceleration, let's say in their teens, then you very well could have had a situation in which the giants were creating their own bloodlines according to each faction. Right. So you have, let's go back to the story of Atlantis. You have Poseidon, who for his portion receives the island of Atlantis. That's his kingdom. That's in the Empire of the Gods. That's Poseidon's piece of the pie. Right. And so you have Poseidon's dynasty over here, and Poseidon would correspond to one of those watchers. Right. And on the other side of the earth, you'd have, you know, you'd have Zeus's dynasty over here with his hybrid offspring. And that dynasty might include not just the hybrid offspring, not just the hybrid sons of the giants, but their hybrid sons that they have with human women before their growth accelerates to a point where they're just too large.
Well, let me ask you something, because the first, in my mind, the first series of children coming from the fallen angels intermingling with women, the Primarch, the first, the primacy, the first of the giant offsprings would have probably been the most largest in physical stature and superior, and then kind of went down a notch, like Hercules, then Achilles, and each time became more manlike.
And that's that the Book of Enoch insinuates that as well. In fact, there's Greek fragments. The Greek version of the Book of Enoch actually describes different races of giants. And we don't know if there were female giants. I mean, could the Watchers control the sowing of their seed? Could they control it, or did they technologically, by technological means, control it so that they're only giving birth to sons? Who knows? I mean, who knows? But I think that what's the likely scenario would be that the giants would be having intercourse with, they would be choose their, just like their fathers did, they would themselves choose wives among the daughters of men, copulate with these women, and create their own dynasties in the family line. So in other words, you have Poseidon, all of his offspring would be the Atlantean Empire, let's call it. So Poseidon, and again, Poseidon would equate to one of the Watchers, would have his empire over here in Atlantis. And so you would have there were 200 Watchers, according to the Book of Enoch. So you would have 200 kingdoms around the world that are governed by the offspring of the Watchers. The Watchers are the gods. They're walking among men as living gods. Their hybrid children are governing the empires. And there's a reason for that. We've talked about that, I think, in the past. But 200 of them all over the earth, they apportioned the earth amongst each other. So they divvied it up amongst themselves. And so these kingdoms are all over the earth. And these kingdoms are going to be enhanced with advanced extraterrestrial knowledge and technology. And so you would have Atlantis-like kingdoms all over the earth. And they would be sharing basically the same culture, basically the same level of civilization. And that's why I call it the Empire of the Gods. And what's really interesting is that in the book of Enoch, part of the judgment before the cataclysm, before the flood, part of the judgment of the watchers was that they would have to behold the destruction of their beloved sons. And how were their sons going to die? They were going to war with each other. God was going to incite them to war with one another, and they would annihilate each other in front of their fathers. The watchers would have to witness the utter annihilation of their offspring in a war.
No Tower of Babel.
And we're talking about before the flood. So this is
I'm talking about the metaphor or the legend that the Lord would never permit a world government. So the Tower of Babel came. It almost sounds like this is another offshoot of the same philosophy.
Right, the predecessor of that.
I wanted to ask you something else. You were describing how they could have delayed giantism until puberty. That may not have happened if you had puberty blockers. Now, before you laugh and think I've lost my mind, I'm linking this potential bloodline into today.
Look at what the
vaccines did. Okay. And I'm on pretty solid ground here. The vaccines destroy DNA. It alters it. It changes our blood. And are they giving us this? I'll just give you a hypothesis. This is just a straight guess, but let's just assume it's their bloodline that you're talking about that's manipulating all the stuff on the earth. And they're trying to destroy the DNA of what they view as the competition, vaccines and whatever else they're doing, GMOs and so forth. And this is the surviving bloodline that's enslaving. And really, if you want to be biblical, it could be descendants of Satan from the fallen angels, and they lost out in the cosmos and they were cast to earth. And this is their ultimate rebellion against God. And in Vance Davis's NSA training, he was taught in 1988 that the bad guys lost, they were cast here, and they had a plot to rob the soul of humans and get back God's prized creation. This was his training in NATO when he was in the NSA. And this is the beginning, I think, of transhumanism. They couldn't get the soul, so they're doing this other crap. And why would they hit us with beta blockers? Because whatever they're going to put upon the earth might lead to the rise of new giants.
Oh, yeah.
And keep us from participating in that process by blocking the DNA. Now, that, Tim, it's just a hypothesis, but I'm looking to link what you're talking about into the modern times, because I think somewhere you're really onto something that could really explain what's going on today.
Well, it's intriguing. The idea that you're going to have to answer a very difficult question, and this would get us into some very controversial ground.
That's okay. We
do. In order for the bloodlines of the watchers, let's call it, okay, the bloodlines of the watchers, that's what we're talking about. Ultimately, it's the bloodline of the watchers, the continuation, because in the antediluvian world, it wasn't Satan and his angels that did this. It was the watchers who did this. And the watchers, very high ranking entities. I think I think watcher is synonymous synonymous with cherub. The watchers are synonymous with the cherubim. I go through that in my book, the princes of the kingdom. These are very high ranking members of the elder race. It would be their bloodlines, but those bloodlines would have to be perpetuated into the post flood world. And how does that happen if all life is destroyed on the earth except for Noah and his family? How does that perpetuation happen?
I've asked that question to some people who are better biblical scholars than me, and I've got to do the research. So the answer is I can't answer that today.
What was their answer? I'm just
curious. Their answer was this, that it's biblical that the offshoot DNA that the Lord wanted to destroy survived.
Well, let me ask you something. If there's nothing new under the sun, as we're told, and we have the ability now to create DNA data banks that we keep way deep in the Arctic, right? could the same thing have been staged at the bottom of the ocean floor underneath so much pressure that nothing can get to it?
Anything is possible when you're dealing with extraterrestrial technology.
Well, do you remember the movie The Abyss? Where you had a bunch of privatized divers that are supposed to be going down and looking for a nuclear submarine that got lost, and they end up confronting extraterrestrials in this entire civilization that was underneath it. It was probably one of the most coolest movies that I can remember thinking of watching when I was a kid. 80s, man, great time. But you know, that type of anomalous activity that is always accounted for the bottom of the floor of the ocean, we can't get to it. We can't create it. We can get to Mars before we can get to the bottom of the ocean.
That's true.
Okay, now we're opening up a line of inquiry that is going to tie us back into the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. And it's going to, as I've already been modifying most people's conception of when the flood occurred. Now, maybe people are upset with that, but I had to go through this myself in order to make the data fit. And it fits like a glove when you push it back to 10,000 BC. But let's further modify the scenario. People are going to get really up in arms about this. Let's further modify the scenario. And now let's contemplate a situation in which not every landmass on planet Earth is completely submerged underwater. Now, let me preface this by saying, for those who, because I was one of these people years ago who thought that the biblical story, the Noahic story, where it says that all of the land was under the water and all that, that was just ironclad, easy to understand, you know, clear as day, biblical narration. You're going to have to go back and rethink that. And the best place to start is to go and look this up with Michael Heiser's work, where he goes through and he postulates, he demonstrates how there could be a different interpretation to some of this. And he, based on the way the words that are used and how those words are used, and it becomes very apparent that there's the possibility within the text, the Genesis narrative, of a different of a different storyline than we're familiar with. A scenario in which the entire Earth, because this correlates to the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, the entire Earth is experiencing a cataclysm. Every corner of the Earth is being affected by this comet impact. In some places, entire bodies of land are submerged under the sea and are still to this day. Catastrophic flooding that would have covered the tops of certain mountains and to that degree in certain parts of the Earth, such as in the Middle East, such as in the Mediterranean Sea, the Mediterranean. So catastrophic flooding all over the Earth. As I said before, extreme volcanism, volcanoes going off all over the place, wildfires all over the place. All of this leads to what's called an impact winter, which is very similar to a nuclear winter. An impact winter happens when you have the dust that's thrown up into the air from the comet impacts combined with the smoke from biomass burning, and you get a blocking out of the radiation of the sun. You get a darkening of the sun for an extended period of time. It's C.S. Lewis's. The White Witch locking Narnia in a perpetual winter type scenario. But all over the Earth is now suddenly thrust back into an ice age. Right. So it's catastrophic. You have mass die off of animals and human beings. Most of humanity is dead. By the way, the giants already killed each other in a big so before this even happens, there's a world war between the kingdoms of the Nephilim going at it with who knows what kind of weapons in their arsenal. According to the Indian epics, they're flying around in Vimanas and they're discharging high energy weapons at each other. You know,
there could nuclear have been weapons in the desert. Yeah, glass.
Exactly. There could have been nuclear explosions. So we're talking about a technological war between the kingdoms of the Nephilim, demigods and mortal men going at it. Again, with who knows what kind of technology before the cataclysm. There's a massive world war before the cataclysm. Then the cataclysm happens. And so the earth is absolutely devastated. I mean, devastated. Almost everything is dead. But not everything. Now, if you take the biblical narrative as we're all used to it, the story of Noah from Sunday school, which may be the case. I'm not saying that this alternative narrative that I'm offering is exactly what happened. It's just, we're just spitballing ideas here. So if you take the biblical narrative at face value, then everything dies except for eight people. You know, everything with breath dies. But you're going to have to explain to me, and that may have been the case. It may be that that is the correct reading, or Michael Heiser may be onto something, and there's an alternative storyline here. But if you take the biblical narrative, then everything is dead except for Noah and his offspring and his family and the animals on the ark. Okay, that's fine with me. I don't have any problem with that. I can explain how those animals repopulated the earth. Because you only need one of every kind, you know, taking advantage of the profound adaptive ability that's built into the mechanism of life that God built in. You take one dog and you get one wolf and you get every single species of canine on planet Earth from one pair of wolves. Okay. You can just do that across the board with every species. So you don't need every single kind of animal the way we think of it. You don't need every kind of dog and every kind of feline and every kind of horse and all that. You only need the base, the very, you know, the pair to create the whole species. So I get that. That's not difficult to explain. Although I do struggle with an interesting question. Okay, so after the flood, everything is dead. Everything is dead. So the animals are coming off the ark. How do those animals that are coming off the ark in Turkey, how do they get to Australia? How do they get to North America? You got to cross an immense ocean to get there. And yes, during this time, because this would have been a mini ice age, yeah, maybe that Bering Strait, that was just a solid piece of ice. And okay, all right. But how'd they get to Australia? They can go to North America that way through Siberia, but how do they get to Australia? How do the animals get across the ocean? It something doesn't make sense here in this scenario. And that's why I'm starting to lean in the other direction, the alternative storyline, that the entire earth was subject to a global cataclysm and almost everything died, but not everything. There were survivors.
Yeah, I think that's probably reasonable. That doesn't discount the fact that Noah put these animals on his ark.
No, not at all. Not at all.
But I tend to think that what you're saying here about the remoteness, I want to just make one observation. You're talking about the watchers in this group and having kingdoms and so forth and warring with each other. If anyone's familiar with the TV series that ran 10 years, Stargate SG-1, that's all covered. Wow. They use different names. But that's all covered, Tim. It's I watched every episode on this because it fit into my understanding of alternative history. And I said, they're paralleling what I think to be true. And they're putting it in this TV. So there were strong messages there. I'm going to go back and decipher. Guys, we're 90 minutes in. And Tim, I'd like you to agree to come back to part two.
Sure.
Because we could do this 5 hours.
This
is just incredible. But we got some bandwidth restrictions on us here that we've gone way over, which is okay, because I don't do it that often, only for opportunities like this.
But, I would certainly come back because we're cracking the lid on a very interesting scenario
We are. I'm telling you, I want you to think of – well, let me ask you this question before we go, though. One last question for me, and then I'll throw it back to Doug for his closure. Lemuria supposedly predates Atlantis. Do you have any information on Lemuria?
I think Lemuria, Atlantis, Mu, all these different mythological, legendary lost cities are referencing the same period of time. It was around 10,000 BC.
I agree with that.
This is when the megaliths were built. This is when the gods were. This is Zeptepi. This is the first time. This is the root and origin of mythology and religion across the globe. That's what we have here. That's what we're talking about. The gods, these extraterrestrial gods, were walking among men. Of course, they were the enemies of God himself. They were the enemies of the kingdom, of the king and his kingdom. But nevertheless, they were walking the earth, teaching mankind who knows what, and in possession of extraterrestrial knowledge, technology, building their kingdoms and so forth. And I think that's when all these lost cities existed. That's when the megaliths were built. That's when everything happened.
Tim, that's why I asked you if the asteroid was a weapon. God's judgment.
I agree with that. And let me just state this. In Genesis, it talks about how there was violence in the land, and that's one of the reasons why God destroyed everything. Originally it was unorganized chaos, and then God brought the violence of the organized chaos and leveled the playing field. And I believe, obviously, we all know that for the rest of the story to be completed, God had to do that. And so I think that explains it. And I firmly believe that what we see as megalithic objects, like what you have been around the world viewing, monitoring, touching, me and you've been in Peru together, and we've actually seen some of these megalithics. Of course, I haven't been there as many times as you have, but I think that is the remnants of the chaos, the organized chaos and violence that God brought to the land. And I think you're just now scraping the surface. But I will warn you, though, and you know this, the pushback from the regular people of the church are going to be hard against this, not just the scientific community. And, you know, here's the thing. I have an open mind about this because I know that my faith lies in Christ, but I don't think that we know everything. And I think the topic is okay to speak about, you know, and I think you've done an excellent job with it. And I can't wait to see what else you are. You're going to demonstrate.
No, we're going to get it in part two, but I got to tell you, your work and my observations in this from afar have deepened my belief in Christ. Because it's made Genesis 6 come alive with all the possibilities that exist. And it's fascinating. It really is.
Yep, the first word.
It really is. Well, guys, let's hold it here. And Doug, you and Timothy can set up a part two. I'm here all week. I leave on Sunday. But, I'd like to follow up sooner rather than later because this begs for a follow-up.
And if I can just remind people that, I was kind of all over the map and not very articulate tonight, but you can find everything we covered in this conversation in a 15-minute video format on my YouTube channel. Just type in Timothy Albrino on YouTube. Mm-hmm. You'll see it's in my Birthright series. It's the latest videos I published. There's a Spanish version and an English. If you get the Spanish one, don't worry. There's an English version of it, too. If you have Spanish-speaking friends, by the way, who you want to start introducing to this stuff, I've got 9 videos in this series in Spanish.
That's awesome.
So you can direct them to that. And also, I detail a lot of this in Birthright in my book. But
how do people get the book, Tim?
They can go to Amazon. It's on Walmart's website, Amazon. It's on Barnes and Noble's website. Not in the stores of Walmart and Barnes and Noble, but it's on their online stores. If you don't like to give Jeff Bezos your money, you can find it all over the place in different little bookstores and stuff like that. But it's definitely on Amazon, and you probably get the best price there. So, but at the very least, go watch that video. It's free content, and it's a much more concise presentation of what I was trying to explain tonight. It's a much more concise and tight, short presentation.
Yeah, well, we expanded it. I mean, that was as much my fault as anybody. And I thought Doug had a couple of really good questions that expanded the issue, too, because what you're talking about, I think, has profound implications for today, even if it's not the way that I see it. I just know that there's a carryover effect.
And then I would love to dig into that next time we talk, because I find that to be really fascinating.
Yeah, I got to tell you this. I'm going to have a hard time getting to sleep tonight. I'm energized. This has been a phenomenal. I knew this was going to be good. And I told my wife, as I was watching your video, in preparation for the interview, I said, this is going to be one of the more fun interviews I've ever done. And it is. I can't wait to do it again. But let's do this sooner rather than later. Tim, thanks for joining us here on the Doug and Dave Intel Report, Heroes Nation. And to all of you, thank you for joining us here on the CommonSenseShow.tv. Take care, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Mountain State Survival covers your basis for your planning, prepping, evacuation, bugging in, or bugging out needs. They carry anything from educational material, camping supplies, emergency services supplies, food, first aid, survival kit and equipment, shooting gear, survival gear, tactical gear. They carry it all. They got it in stock. Give Mountain State Survival a ring. That's mountain-state-survival.com. Get this type of supplies while you still can. 304-517-6935. Mountain State Survival is one of the only places that I know of currently that is still carrying the delicious Peak Refuel meal that is ready to eat. It's personally the only thing that I eat at this point whenever I go out camping, whenever we have any type of emergency or disaster situation. That is the meal that I stick with, and you can find that at mountain-state-survival.com. Use Rekker5 for a 5% discount on your overall purchase. That's Rekker5, mountainstatesurvival.com.
All stations, all call signs. Prepare for transmission. This is Wrecker Actual. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. End of transmission.